Now, as you may know, the Greek island of Lesvos is experiencing a humanitarian refugee crisis. By this month, almost 14 million Syrians had fled their homes as a result of the Syrian civil war. Close to 8 million are internally displaced within Syria, and over 6 million have sought refuge in neighbouring Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan and Iraq. Hundreds of thousands have migrated onwards to the Middle East, North Africa and Europe, many of them via the Greek island of Lesvos. As of this month, the United Nations has identified 13.5 million Syrians requiring humanitarian assistance. Sean Wright has been volunteering on Lesvos to help with the crisis, and I'm pleased to say that Sean joins me now. Good afternoon, Sean.
Good afternoon, Bob.
Thanks so much for coming in today, and well done for what you've done out there. We're going to hear all about that in a moment. But perhaps you could firstly tell us how you got involved in volunteering out there.
Well, I got involved basically off my own back. It was I'd become interested in geopolitics, right, and started reading up, and it's been an ongoing process for the last 2 years from a man who never really was involved in politics and was ignoring stuff, and gradually started delving in, seeing what was going on in the world, and gradually the crisis revealed itself to me. Yeah. And the main reason I went was for my kids, because I'm always telling them that you can make a difference.
Yeah.
And they say to me, well, what can you do? And I say, well, you can change, you can make a change. And I decided I'd better take my own advice. So I basically booked up a flight, picked a week, and decided I was going to go and help. Wow. And that was it.
Wow. Well, you know, many of us, myself included, sit on social media and moan about this and moan about that, thinking that maybe we're doing something useful, but in actual fact, you've got to get up and do something like you've done to really make a difference, haven't you?
Yes. It's a strange thing, because you kind of, there was a part of me that felt like I was going to just kind of stare and see what was going on.
Right, yeah.
But you kind of pushed that aside, because that wasn't the reason I was going. I was going with a very open mind to see what was happening, on the ground. It just push aside whatever you've read, whatever you've heard, and see what really is happening there. And it would be something I'd recommend to everybody,
right,
but not everybody can do it, and they're not going to accept everybody over there. But it's a life changer. It really is a life changer. Mm. You come home and everything looks quite different.
Oh yeah, yeah. So did you go out there with an organisation or totally independently?
No, totally independently. I booked my flight up. I hadn't booked up my accommodation. And I was looking at some groups on Facebook, and there was a lady who came up with some accommodation. So I contacted her, and she was basically affiliated to a group called Better Days for Moira, which is a charity that's built up around the main registration point in Moira.
Right.
And once I got over to Lesvos, had a chat with her, went and worked there for the week. So it's the busiest place on the island,
right,
where the refugees, they all have to go through this same point. So
okay, so you've arrived in Lesvos, you just got off the plane. What were your first impressions when you arrived?
First impression, funnily enough, the first impressions, I got there quite late at night, about 8:30, and came out of the airport. It was very small, jumped in a cab, and there was an Australian, man in front. He's probably mid-30s, so he's a bit younger than me. And there was a young Greek man sitting next to me, spoke perfect English, and the Greek driver spoke English, and we're driving along, and we're sort of chatting about why we're there. And the young Greek bloke next to me, he's probably mid-20s, he was in the army, and he basically said it was really nice that people were coming over to help,
yeah,
the refugees, and the cab driver was the same. And they, once I got out of the cab, they both wished me good luck.
Oh, brilliant. So, yeah. So how did you get involved then, and what work did you do while you were out there?
The work I did, the first day was quite quiet. The days change. It depends how many refugees are coming through, what's happening.
Yeah, yeah.
So basically, the camp is about 6 miles from Mytilene is where I stayed, which is the main, it's in the south of the island.
Yeah.
And the first day involved, funny enough, it involved cleaning out tents where the people had been sleeping.
Okay.
So the people come, they go, the most sort of vulnerable families, individuals are put up in these tents. And these tents are the overspill from the main built up UN facilities, which are on the other side.
Okay.
So we get the overspill, and they get the overspill when they go in the tent. So we're clearing out the tents.
Yeah.
It's just basically clearing out rubbish and helping to keep the camp tidy. That was the first day.
Okay.
Didn't have much interaction with the refugees that day. But it changed. It did change quite rapidly.
Right.
So
So what did that change into?
The next day involved there was a few boats that had come in overnight. It was quite, because when there's bad weather. I mean, when I arrived, the wind was really bad. I nearly didn't land on Mytilene. The flight had to turn round and try and land again.
Right.
And the flights during the day had been cancelled. So that stops any boats coming over, because enough of them drown anyway. But there's so many of them in these small dinghies that any kind of rough weather, and they really can't go out. So the next day it had calmed down. So quite a few boats had come through, and. I basically got involved in the clothing line, which is the people come off the coaches, they've been taken from the shore on the boats, and a lot of them are very wet.
Yes, yeah.
Either fallen in, people turning up with rucksacks, that's their whole life in a rucksack.
Yeah.
And a lot of them lose that, it goes overboard, and then they're soaking wet. And they get in, we basically bind them dry clothing and whatever we've got. So there's a big tent with lots of clothing, shoes, socks for children, women, and I was basically trying to organise a line.
Okay.
Because they spend their lives lining up, queuing for this, queuing for clothes, queuing for food. Yeah.
So where does all this clothing come from? Is some of it recycled from earlier refugees?
There is now. There's a group called the Dirty Girls of Lesbos who... and they basically, they decided that... Because these clothes are just getting thrown away, blankets getting thrown away. You know, the refugee crisis, because it's a refugee crisis, is humanitarian crisis. It's an environmental crisis as well.
Yeah.
The amount of rubbish and stuff. And the clothes were just getting put in waste tips. So they decided, could they recycle them? And they organised basically an industrial cleaning service where the clothes are collected and washed and brought back. But most of them, all them clothes originally, they're donations. They're donations from people from over here, from around the world.
Right.
So,
okay. What about sanitation? I mean, there's obviously got to be dealt with out there. How are they dealing with that?
Well, sanitation, originally the camp sprung up, and this is a story, it's a bit squeamish for mid-afternoon,
right.
But originally the camp sprung up, and it was called Afghan Hill because... There were so many Afghans, but it's on the, if you imagine like an olive grove, it's on a peak and it goes up to, one side goes down to an already a detention camp that's already there, so it's already built up and concreted. The other side is the olive grove where the camp that I worked at is built up. And originally, the overspill from the UN camp, where there was nowhere to put them, nowhere to sleep, and people would turn up in their thousands, they were basically sleeping out in the open on this hill, and there was no toilets.
No.
There was nothing. So they were defecating. They were urinating on that hill.
Yeah.
That hill was awash with fecal matter, and they were sleeping there. They had to sleep there in the wind, in the rain, if it rained.
Yeah, right.
But there are toilets now. There's plenty of portable toilets now built up around for people. So
good. So can you talk us through what happens to the refugees once they land on the beach, basically?
Once they land on the beach, there's different types of volunteering. I mean, you can work your way around the island, but a lot of people volunteer. That it's just strange because you'd kind of call it the glamorous stuff. Pulling them off the boats when they come in, and that's a lot of the pictures you see. So there's people who patrol the south, people who patrol the north. The boats are basically spotted. They come in, they try to give them safe landing. They'll try to give them dry clothes there if they've got any.
Right.
But then originally from the north, the island's quite big. It's I think it's about 60 kilometres away in the north.
Right.
But they can put them onto buses. If there was no buses... Originally, they used to walk from the north of the island 60 kilometres down, and they have to go to Moira, which is where I was working, and where the registration point is.
Okay.
So they come from there. They either come on the bus or they were walking. Most of them come on buses now. And they arrive, and then they're fed, clothed, whatever, and then they have to queue up and get a ticket, and they're put in different lines. So the Syrians, the Afghanistans, and the Iraqis... they get a preference. The Afghans and the Iraqis had their own line. The Syrians had their own line.
Right.
And it changed. It was quite fluid. It did change on during my time there. And then you get a few people like Pakistanis, Moroccans, and stuff like that. But I've got the exact figures here. But they are 90. It's like 90% Syrians, okay. Afghans, Iraqis.
Yeah.
Get a ticket. So you get a ticket, and you're deemed an Afghani or an Iraqi. And then once you've queued up, got your tickets, you have to go and queue up again and get registered, and you get registered with Frontex, who are dealing with the Greek police, and that's when you get your registration papers as a refugee.
Okay. Who are Frontex?
Frontex are the European, they're the European group that control the borders.
Okay.
They're basically the border control for the EU.
Oh, okay, right.
So
okay.
They control the outside. Everyone's heard of the Schengen zone there because it comes up constantly on the news.
Yeah.
They control the outside border of that. So they want free trade and everyone crossing the borders inside. They don't want anybody coming in from outside. So you have to have a visa to come through from the other side.
Okay, well, you've mentioned the UN and Frontex, and there's various voluntary organisations out there. Is anyone actually taking charge and overseeing everything, do you know?
Well, that's a big question.
Yeah.
It's a big question. Well, basically, the EU should be taking charge, and we should be... It's a very political question that we should be taking charge. The US are involved in this because they're part... They're to blame as well. Well, in fact, they're hugely to blame, and we're hugely to blame as well.
Yeah.
You've got the... In Moira, you've got the registration camp, and that's the UN. So the UN UN Refugee Council, they're the ones looking after the refugees there. You had the Danish Refugee Council. There was also a bit of work from Help to Save the Children.
Right, okay.
And there's some work from Médecins Sans Frontières, the Doctors Without Borders.
Yep.
So the biggest one is the UN, but I suspect they're underfunded.
Yeah.
And you could say allegedly, deliberately, but that there is in control of there. You've got the Greek police trying to control them as well, but it was a bit mishap.
It was a bit.
Really, when you go there, there's no one. It doesn't seem like there's anyone in control. And the camp that I was in, the Better Days for Moria, allied to the official camp. The volunteers like me and the volunteers in that camp were actually doing the jobs of what the UN volunteers should have been doing, like controlling the registration lines.
Right.
Because these people, most of them don't speak English. Quite a big majority do, especially the Syrians, because they love English, and a lot of them do English decrees and stuff.
Sure, yeah.
But the lines kind of need to be controlled, or they get out of hand. And the Greek police, not known for the patience.
No, I was going to ask this. I mean, I've heard some horror stories about some of the things that the Turkish police are doing on the other side. How are the Greek police dealing with the refugees?
I think it's kind of a slightly cultural thing. If you've ever been to Greece, they're kind of macho. The Greek police are very macho, but...
Gun strapped to their
side.
Yeah,
but if you actually talk to them...
Yeah.
Most of them are very helpful.
Right.
Very helpful. Once you get past that hard facade, that they were quite good. But and I think they'd come to realise from what I see during that week is that they needed the volunteers. They needed volunteers to help control them lines, to get people in, keep families together, keep Afghanistan in one line, and Iraqis in another, and so on.
So they've developed a good relationship.
The only problem now is on the ground. I was in there, I think it was the second week in January. Since then, it's changed. It's been changing all the time. And whereas I could walk in to that camp, I could walk into the official camp. You just go in a high vis vest, and they kind of knew who you were because you were helping out.
Yeah.
Now you need official accreditation. You need to be registered to get into that camp. And where there used to be a couple of entrances, there's only one, and that is now policed. They only let official people in. And I don't think it's not because they don't need the help. I would beg to find out why they don't want them in. I think. You could say it's for safety, but I'd say it's more for they don't want to be seen to be not doing enough. Okay. They want to, and then they what they need. It's, I think the authorities probably need to feel like they're in control.
Yeah.
So if you control the volunteers, it's
Well, you mentioned earlier about politics, and you didn't want to be too political, but you're entitled to your opinion. And really, do you think the authorities, for want of a better word, are doing enough out there?
Well, I did. I brought a bit of information in. It's good, and it's if you read the news, it's a migrant crisis.
Yeah.
And everything you read, if you Google, it would be a migrant crisis.
Yeah.
And they're concentrating on Syrians, but the official figures, and this is the official figures from yesterday.
Right.
And I'll give you the makeup of the refugees that arrived in Lesbos. And the refugees, this is the last in January, the refugees that arrived in Lesbos, what we got? 39% were Syrian.
Right.
And we got 25% Afghanistanis, and we got, was that 20% Iraqis, and then there's various other ones after that.
Yeah.
It's not just a Syrian crisis. This is a Middle East crisis. The people coming through, they're Syrian, Afghanistanis, they're Iraqis. They're all war zones. They're places that we have had a lot of involvement in. We've bombed. We've even Syria. See, you say we didn't involve the Arab Spring in 2011. It was a Syrian up. It was a Syrian uprising that was brought down by Assad quite violently and still is.
And it was encouraged and supported by the West, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, the official figure. Yeah, you can read. It was from I've got papers. If you look on WikiLeaks from 2006, that the United States were. Which is a common thing. They try to promote sectarian divides, and the WikiLeaks papers, I can bring them out. They show that from 2006, the United States were involved in trying to get the opposition to actually divide and bring down Assad. But the Syrian opposition is quite poor, Assad was always going to stay in control. And it's not about Assad being in control.
No.
It's
one big horrible mess, isn't it?
Yeah, it's about oil, and it's about money, and it's about position in the Middle East. And if you can go back, this is colonialism. They call it US exceptionalism, the states are exceptional and they're better than everyone. They should be the world's policemen.
Yeah.
And then we follow obediently.
All right. Well, I mean, back to Lesbos. What about the residents of Lesbos? How is it affecting them, and how are they kind of taking the situation?
They were generally very good. I do hear of bits of trouble out there. I think there's a few right wing protests and sort of protests against refugees and what's going on in the island, but generally the people, they're fantastic.
Really?
Yeah. Fantastic. But they are losing a huge amount of money now because their tourism business is
well, of course, it's been affected.
It's been affected hugely, and you can I follow it on Facebook still, and you can see what's going on in the ground, and the Greek people are just kind of appealing. They're basically being left to it, and you get back to the political bit of the Greeks are being blamed for everything because they're allowing people to turn up on their shores, and they can't turn them back round.
No, what else are they supposed to do?
They can't turn them back round.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier when we were talking off air that there's been some changes in the last few days involving the UN, I think you said.
Well, what had happened, it was about 2 weeks ago, they had started. The Turkish Coast Guard and the Greek Coast Guard had started to coordinate, and they were meeting the boats. I'll give you the story. They're meeting the boats. So the refugees turn up in Turkey. They find someone to smuggle them through. They pay them between 1,000 to 2,000 euros. They get on the boat. Sometimes they're forced on the boats a lot of the time, even when the weather's bad. If the weather gets... And sometimes people will turn up and say, I'm not going on that boat. They force them on. So they get on the boat, and the Turkish Coast Guard had basically been, from 2 weeks ago, escorting them out to Greek water.
Right.
And then the Greeks had been picking them up and taking them to a large Frontex boat.
Right.
Which would register them on the boat, up to 400 individuals at a time, take them straight back to Mytilene. and then they would buy a ferry ticket, because once they're registered, they can get a ferry ticket, and then they get the ferry to Athens.
Okay.
And that's what had been going on. So there wasn't so many boats turning up, but now that seems to have calmed down, and they've stopped doing that. So the boats are coming through and still turning up on Lesbos. But from today, NATO have got involved, and they've got some ships out there patrolling.
Right.
And they're going to turn the boats. They're going to pick these people up. That's what they say they're going to do. And they're going to return them to Turkey.
Oh, really?
Which is, if you think about it, if you just forget the law, forget the humanitarian, forget anything. It costs them 1,000 to 2,000 euros to get across.
Yeah.
It costs 15 euros if you get the ferry from Turkey to Mytilene. And they're still allowing these people to get in the boats, come out, they're going to pick them up, they're going to turn around, they're going to put them back into Turkey. So it's basically EU is trying to sweep it back. They don't want people coming into Europe. And they're trying to sweep it back under the carpet. But what you've got now, you've got thousands and thousands of refugees building up, and they're building up on the Greek borders, because places like Serbia, Macedonia, Austria are all shutting their borders and turning them back round.
Yeah.
And they've got nowhere to go. So I only see it getting worse. I see people dying at borders now, not just drowning. They're going to be dying at Serbian borders. Serbian police have apparently, they've not been too kind to them. And it's Afghanistani people with a legitimate right to travel to Germany are being turned back. It seems that only the Syrians are getting through at the moment. So it's changing all the time.
Yeah.
But I think in a couple of months' time, you're going to be, if it gets reported, there's going to be a lot of people dying actually just out in the open on the borders, but they do die now anyway. So.
Yeah. Well, you left me speechless.
It's not the prettiest picture.
I really don't know what to say about that.
I said earlier, that it's reflected as a migrant crisis, and the definition of a migrant is a person who moves from one place to another to find work for better living conditions.
Yeah,
they're not. These people are refugees. They're fleeing for their lives.
Yeah,
they're fleeing for that. You may be a case. There's the occasional what they class an economic migrant, whatever that may be.
Very small percentage.
But it's a very small percentage.
Yeah.
They are all refugees, and when you meet these people, they're just normal people.
Yeah.
They're just normal people. Most of them are fantastic. Some are horrible. It's just a normal cross section of people.
Yeah. Are there a lot of families coming across?
Loads of families. Yeah. There is an awful lot of families. The figures I've got here, and I'll give you the percentage of children, was 23% of children.
Wow.
Yeah. It's more than that. Sorry, that's the women. It's 36% of children.
Wow.
44% men.
Okay, well, it's fascinating. I could talk to you forever, but we are running out of time a little bit. But I suppose we should move on to what's the biggest need out there at the moment, and how can people here help the situation? What's the best thing we could do?
The biggest need is there are so many charities helping out with food, clothing. I think the biggest need is if there's someone taking... would be money, actually, because I think the charities out there know what they need. So I know if they need shoes or clothes.
Yeah.
And if people want to donate and they find a charity that's going to give money out, then I think this will apply to Calais as well. Just help out as much as you can. Just don't go to your local coffee shop and spend £4
on a coffee.
Helping out. Yeah. And what can we do? I think we can learn to actually look a bit deeper in what we're actually told.
Yeah.
And then once you find out that these people aren't coming to steal your jobs, coming to invade your country, that you should be putting pressure on the government to change things, because that's the only way you're going to get real change. We can, at the drop of a hat, go to war, but we can't, at the drop of a hat, go and save people. And it doesn't make no sense. And we, as I said to my children, another one of the reasons I went is because I feel partly to blame, because I'm from a country that has a huge significant role in why these people are having to move out from their homes, why they're having to leave their own countries. So,
Well, Sean, thank you very much. I mean, in practical terms, can you give us the names of a couple of charities that you think would be a good idea to support?
Yeah, if you look up Better Days for Moira, that will come up. And if you just put Google in Lesvos volunteering, there'll be a list of charities that come up. I think there's one called Starfish,
right,
and the Dirty Girls of Lesvos who do the cleaning. It sounds like such a funny thing, but it's such an important role. They're just recycling them clothes. So any little charity, they're fantastic little charities, and they're grassroots charities that are fantastic. They change consistently with what goes on the ground. So
okay, doing great work. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Sean, for coming in, telling us your amazing story. It's been absolutely fascinating, and I'm full of admiration for you that you actually got up and went out there and made a difference. I think most people would like to help refugees, but you actually did something positive and gave your effort. So, Sean Wright, thank you for that, and thank you for coming in and telling us all about it today. It's absolutely fascinating.
No, thank you.